Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, the environmental impact of illegal mining or galamsey in Ghana and the possible effects it's having on newborn babies.
The babies were born with congenital deformities, some without limbs, some with transparent skin.
Also, visa-free travel around the continent is still more of an aspiration than a reality for Africans. But there are improvements.
Most increases are fairly small, but significant increases would have been from Eritrea, Sao Tome and Principe. Central African Republic has also increased quite a bit. Angola is one of the high flyers this year in the index, and Sierra Leone as well. I think those two are the countries that have improved the most.
It's Tuesday, the 3rd of December. First, we go to Nigeria. What you're hearing is the Muslim call to prayer, the Adhan. It was recorded in Tudunbiri in northwest Kaduna State in Nigeria. A year ago, during a similar moment of prayer, tragedy struck when the military accidentally bombed a religious festival, leaving dozens of people dead and many more injured. The strikes happened against the backdrop of an insurgency the military had been fighting for years. Armed groups and criminal gangs operate freely in the north, across borders, robbing, raiding and kidnapping for ransom. An increase in the use of drones has resulted in what are called accidental airstrikes targeting civilians. My colleague Azizat Ola Oluwa has been to Tudunbiri in Kaduna. We began our conversation with a recap of what happened on that terrible day in December last year.
So last year, December the 3rd, people of Tudunbiri gathered in the evening to celebrate the birthday of their prophet Muhammad. They called Maulud, and it was supposed to be like overnight event. But about 10 p.m., they said a bomb was dropped on them and many people died. They said they saw that plane or something was hovering above them even after the first bomb dropped. So they quickly switched off the generator so that whomever was dropping the bomb wouldn't see them and be able to attack them further. There is no network, no telephone network in Tudunbiri. Even when we filmed, for the hours we spent there for the 2 days, there was no network. So it was hard for them to get information out that we are not terrorists, we are not criminals. So the person that was coming to help them to find out what was going on so he could get the information back to the city became like the target, because it was the headlight of the motorcycle was like the target for the military to drop the second bomb, which, you know, killed more people. So at the end of the day, officially, authorities said about 85 people died, but more people got injured. Because, you know, the Islamic calendar isn't fixed like the actual calendar we use. So for this year, the event was held in October, and that was the day we went.
This was a huge tragedy, and it's just a year. How are people doing now? How are the families coping when you spoke to them? What did they tell you?
So people are still grieving. You know, there is hardly a household in Tudunbiri that is not affected by the tragedy, either losing somebody or somebody got injured and is yet to heal. I spoke to Abdurrashid Masood, and he talked to me about how his family is affected by this.
Anytime I come here, I always remember what happened and I feel heartbroken. We saw dead bodies all over the place as if they were sleeping.
So that was Abdurrashid Masood talking to me about the memory he always gets whenever I visited the site of the bombing, where the authorities have built a new mosque for them. So he said that he would never forget what happened. And then he went to talk to me about how he is personally affected. His two daughters got involved in the bombing.
When my daughter and the others that got injured were at the hospital, they were well taken care of. We thank the government for that, but things changed after they got discharged months later. The hospital has refused to continue with their treatment. They keep giving us excuses. Anytime I look at my daughter's wound, I feel sad.
That's Masood Abdurrashid, whose two daughters were affected by the bombings in Tudunbiri a year ago. Azizat, how did the military justify this incident? I mean, it's a truly painful thing to happen to people. 85 and more people dead.
Absolutely. It was really a sad incident. And surprisingly, actually, Audrey, the military came out to own up to their mistakes. They said that it was a mix-up, you know, in the intelligence they got, because they thought that criminal gangs were the ones gathering there, and that was why they bombed the place. And I spoke to the spokesperson of the military, who again reiterated how sorry they were, and also find a way to support the victims and the entire residents of Tudumbiri.
The terrorists know we're after them, and they carry out nefarious activities around some of these communities. They use some of these communities as a shield for their activities.
That was Major General Edward Buba, the spokesperson of the Nigerian military, talking to me about why it's difficult for them to be able to determine who is a criminal or not, because most of these bandits, insurgents and terrorists are not in military uniforms, so they can't identify them easily. And these criminal gangs usually use civilians as a shield, which makes the work of the military even more difficult in their counter-terrorism efforts.
With the growing use of drones in military operations in Nigeria, do the military and the government now have safeguards in place where they don't just do things like what happened in Tudunbiri? It was a tragedy, but the reasons given by the military spokesperson there tells us about the difficulties they may have. But do they have safeguards that would make sure that this doesn't happen again?
Absolutely. He said that he put measures in place and that kind of incident would never, ever happen again. And in fact, they've started, you know, to train and retrain their operatives operating the drones. They are going to redeploy some officials that they know if they are not competent enough, they will not be taking up some responsibilities, and they will carry out due diligence before they engage in airstrikes, that what happened would never happen again. And they've got so many measures in place. And he also said that two officials have been indicted in the erroneous airstrikes and they are facing court-martial process at the moment.
That must be reassuring to people that somebody is being held accountable for it and the continuous apology that the military is offering to people there. But I'm wondering about public trust in the military, because people in Nigeria are used to the military actually not accepting a responsibility for some of the actions that they take. So talk to us about the relationship between the people and the military.
You couldn't have said it better, Audrey. And I put the same question to the military spokesperson. And he said that that was one of the reasons they decided to come out clean to the public, to show them that it would not be business as usual, that they want to try to be more open, transparent, and be more accountable, you know, for their actions, because they've realized that they are waging in conventional warfare against enemies that are not easily identified. It's imperative for them to be able to work with the civilians, to work with the people in any community they find themselves. And the only way they can do that is to build trust. That was exactly what the researcher of Human Rights Watch, Anyete Ewang, told me, that the military and the authorities in Nigeria generally need to be more transparent, you know, so that the public can trust them better.
The Nigerian ministry has a long history of human rights abuses and a failure to ensure accountability. We need to see the authorities take much needed action towards justice, accountability, and compensation for victims in all of the other incidences of airstrikes where they have accepted that it was an error.
That's Anyete Ewang of Human Rights Watch in Nigeria. Has the Nigerian government learned lessons from this, do you think? Because she was referring there to other airstrikes, so it seems like that it might have still been happening to communities that they get caught up in this war.
Unfortunately, there have been at least 17 erroneous airstrikes since 2017 in Nigeria, and most of them were even carried out by the Nigerian Air Force, also part of the military. And that was what Anyete of Human Rights Watch was referring to, that, okay, this is a first. The army has come up to say that we are sorry for what happened in Tudunbiri last year. But what about justice for the other victims of erroneous airstrikes in the past that you've pretty much, you know, pushed their stories under the carpet because you don't want to talk about it? You prefer to just let the stories die like that. But activists like Anyete and other human rights campaigners have been calling for justice for these people, and at least for authorities to own up to their mistakes so that it doesn't happen again.
That's the BBC's Azizat Ola Oluwa, who's been to Tudunbiri in Kaduna to hear what's been happening since the airstrikes that killed at least 85 people last December. Now to Ghana. And a BBC investigation into the health and environmental impact of illegal mining in the southwest. The BBC has found that water around an illegal gold mining site there contains around 500 times more mercury than the World Health Organization guidelines for safe drinking water. Testing was carried out by the government's Water Research Institute. Mercury is used to extract gold from lakes and rivers. It's also a highly toxic substance and damages kidneys, lungs, and nervous systems. The danger is not just from drinking the water from nearby boreholes. It enters the ecosystem, infecting fish, which are exported and eaten by people far from Ghana. No one is safe from the effects of mercury contamination. Thomas Nadi is in Ghana for the BBC, and he's been to one of these mines. He spoke to doctors who've been seeing birth defects in babies and also the young men and women who work in these illegal mines.
Well, it's not easy going into the forest, deep into forest in Western Ghana to interview miners. I remember doing that in 2021, and then I went back to see if the situation has improved. We managed to establish contact and build trust with an illegal miner who took us deep into the forest. We had to go by road. We got to a point the vehicle couldn't go, so we had to use a tricycle. And then we got to another point, the tricycle couldn't move, and we had to trek deep into the jungle. And we trekked for about some 15, 30 minutes. Then we suddenly emerged into a very large field of illegal mining activities. And we had already established contact with them. They were aware we are coming. And then we went in there. We saw what they were doing. We spoke to some of them. And what I was particularly interested in is just to find out why they continue to mine despite the destructive impact of their activities. And this is what some of them told me.
I'm aware of the health issues associated with illegal mining. We spoil most of the rivers, and now there is no clean water. I don't have anything else to do apart from mining.
Especially in the places where you went, tell us about what people told you there.
So we visited Axim in southwestern Ghana, which is also an area where a lot of mining activities take place. We just wanted to find out whether illegal mining activities is affecting the people, the health of the people living in that area. So we visited this hospital and were shocked to hear that the doctors there are beginning to record very unusual health cases. Let's take a listen to the director of the hospital.
We've had deliveries that the babies were born with congenital deformities, some without limbs, some with transparent skin. Then we also had children having kidney problems. Then we think that it may have a link with the galamsey.
That's Dr. Norbert Asante at a hospital in Axim. So tell us about how law enforcement and government officials are trying to stop illegal mining, because it's become an election issue and many Ghanaians are saying that this is not just a local thing, this is a very highly organized thing, and it's organized by politicians as well.
Yes, there have been allegations that some politicians are involved in this, but BBC hasn't been able to independently verify that. We spoke to some miners who said that they have sponsors, and their sponsors also have people supporting them. Some of them are politicians, some of them are influential people in society, and they are those aiding this kind of activity. And so some people think that it's one of the reasons why it's been so difficult for the authorities to completely ban illegal mining. And illegal mining didn't just start today. For more than a decade, Ghana has struggled to deal with this particular problem. And several approaches have been used. There have been times they've deployed the military, and even currently they've deployed the military to try to flush out the illegal miners. But it's not working. It's not making much difference. Some of the miners have told us that the police people who normally come there would take money from them. We haven't been able to also independently verify that, but that's what they've told us. And so there are elements of corruption, allegations. People too are saying that they have no other source of livelihood. That's what they depend on. So it's been very difficult for the authorities to deal with this problem.
What's in it for the miners? They say that they don't have any other means of making money, but do they make money out of this? Is it a good living for them to make? It is dangerous. So is it lucrative?
Audrey, it's a very tempting and lucrative business. Some miners make up to $2,000 a week. Others make over $5,000 a month. Now, let me just put this in perspective. The average salary of a Ghanaian worker is around $180. And so if a miner within a week can make up to $2,000, that it will take special grace for that person to stop what he is doing and then to be given a different job. And what type of job would the authorities be able to provide that will give that amount of money to somebody who is engaged in this kind of activity? And so that's why it's been very difficult for them to stop. And you speak to some of the miners, they tell you that, well, I'm interested in doing business. I just want to get the capital, mine here, get the capital. Once I'm able to raise enough money, I'll open a shop, then I'll start operating and I'll stop the illegal mining. We know, and as you heard in that clip, they know very well the impact of their activities, the health implications and all that. And so they just want to make money. Some of them just want to make money and be able to start their own business so that they can stop.
Are they mostly young men, or is it young men and women, or people of all ages?
You'll be surprised to know that some of these illegal miners are university graduates. Because of the current unemployment situation, they have no option but to go into that kind of activity. Most of the, I think two of the people I spoke to are university graduates. One of them owned a concession and then employed other people who were working. And some of these workers are young people, some ages of 20, 25, 30, thereabouts. So these are young people. They have no other alternative, as they told us, and that's their only source of livelihood. Some come from the north of the country to come and work in southern Ghana, and others too are just from communities within the area.
And women involved in this, young women?
And of course, yes, there are young women involved in it. And we spoke to a young lady from northern Ghana who said that a friend introduced her to Galamsey because she was complaining of lack of job. She didn't know what to do. And the friend suggested that she should try and then be what they call a laborer, work for somebody on site so that at the end of the day, they'll pay her some money. So she specifically told us that she wants to just raise some money and be able to get capital to open a shop. Because the job is very dangerous. She's been injured a couple of times on the field. And so she just wants to get the money, raise enough capital, be able to start her own business and then stop illegal mining.
We've been hearing about the long-term effects of this, the damage to people's health, their prospects, future opportunities.
Yeah.
How concerned is the government and the current campaigners, because Ghana's preparing for presidential elections? It is an election issue. What are the candidates saying about fixing it? Because it's damaging health, it's damaging the environment, people don't have jobs, and they're doing these dangerous illegal mining activities. Is anybody in the political sphere addressing this in the campaigns that they're running now?
That's an interesting question, because both parties have struggled to deal with this problem. When Mahama was former vice president, John Mahama was in government, he struggled to deal with Galamsey. This government has also struggled, and it's become a major campaign issue. Ghanaians are watching closely, and it will be one of the main determining factors in this particular election.
Was there anything that stood out for you, Thomas? You've been reporting the story for several years now, this time around, about what the miners or the people who live in those mining areas told you.
It's just the health impact of the mining activities. The time that I started following illegal mining activity, I started reporting on illegal mining in southern Ghana, we were not hearing of unusual health cases. This time around, they are beginning to see it. They are beginning to record it. Although scientifically, it's not been proven that it's linked to the mining activities, but that's been the concern of health professionals. And so they are worried. And now studies are being conducted to try to understand whether there's a linkage between the chemicals used for the mining and also the deformities and the health impacts on, or some of the unusual health cases that they are recording. For me, that's what stood out in this whole process. And I'm still trying to understand how people will sacrifice their health at the expense of looking for gold. It's just shocking. If you go to some of the mining areas and you fly a drone and you look at the extent of damage to the environment is disheartening.
That's Thomas Nadi in Ghana. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. How easy is it for you to visit another African country with an African passport? The experts tell us that it's becoming easier to move as countries ease up their visa requirements. In the last year, for example, it was easier to travel to Sierra Leone, Angola, and the Central African Republic, according to the Africa Visa Openness Index. But Kenya, Cameroon, and Burkina Faso have made it more difficult to enter their borders. In fact, Kenya's ranking on the index dropped 17 places due to the introduction of an electronic travel authorization, or ETA, earlier this year. And there I was thinking that that makes it easier to get into Kenya. We'll hear why that's actually not the case. Now, it's an ambition held by African countries that citizens of the continent should move freely without the hassle of a visa. But very few countries live up to that dream, so let's name them. Benin, Rwanda, Seychelles, and the Gambia. Take your flowers. There really should be more countries, but here we are. So why is unrestricted travel still just a dream? Eckhart Naumann is an independent economist and associate of the Trade Law Center in Cape Town, and he's got some answers. So let's talk about the easing of visa restrictions in Africa for Africans. How is it going?
Well, it's going fairly well. There's been a lot of progress made over the last 9 years in terms of, for example, what is being measured by the African Visa Openness Index. In fact, it's been a 40% improvement in terms of visa-free travel permutations since 2016. So in this 9-year period, we've seen quite an improvement. It has eased a little bit over the last couple of years. In other words, the growth in visa openness hasn't proceeded at the same pace, perhaps, as the early years. But there is still progress being made. And in particular, over the last year, some countries have regressed a little bit. And the bulk of countries has maintained its score over the previous year.
So Benin, Rwanda, Seychelles and the Gambia have no restrictions for Africans. Tell me which countries have regressed in the last year or so.
Cameroon is one country that has a slightly lesser score this year. Burkina Faso has regressed a little bit. Mali has regressed a bit. Ethiopia has regressed a bit. There are 8 countries that score lower this year than they did last year. Another country that has scored lower, and I think that probably is subject of another discussion or another question perhaps, is Kenya, that is markedly lower this year than it was last year. And then there's Togo, which is also scoring much lower this year, and that is as a result of implementing an e-visa process ahead of travel from previously allowing a visa on arrival. So the way it works on the index, certain scores are allocated to certain categories of visa, and if it is a visa on arrival, it does score higher than any visa that is required ahead of travel. Most increases are fairly small, but significant increases would have been from Eritrea, albeit off a very low base, Sao Tome and Principe. Central African Republic has also increased quite a bit. Angola is one of the high flyers this year in the index as having increased a lot, and Sierra Leone as well. I think those two are the countries that have improved the most in this year's report.
Tell me about Eritrea, a very low base, and Eritrea is often described as the North Korea of Africa. What have they improved? What's happened? Who can go now that couldn't go before?
I think in fairness with Eritrea, Eritrea is currently the second lowest ranked country on the index. It still requires a visa ahead of travel from all countries apart from Kenya now, which is a very nominal, very small increase. It doesn't impact on its ranking on the index. It is still the second last country, but its percentage score, albeit small, certainly is showing an improvement.
So which is the lowest?
Sudan is the lowest and has been the lowest, I think, for the last year or two.
Right. And for obvious reasons, there's a war going on there.
Yeah, unfortunately, it does make travel, certainly official travel, a lot more difficult. Also bearing in mind that what actually happens at the border, sometimes certainly land borders, might not always reflect official policies of a country. So a country might maintain a certain visa policy, but on the ground, sometimes the situation is a little bit different or might be a little bit more fluid, or there might be refugees and others that are traveling across borders that may not have formal travel documents. So the reality, the lived realities by African citizens is often not fully reflected in a country's official visa policy, but certainly it is reflective of their general policy as being very restrictive in terms of easing the movement of persons.
What actually goes into these decisions? Because the European Union, for instance, has had open border travel for more than 20 years now. Why is it so difficult for African countries to achieve the same thing?
I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between the aspirations of African countries and the Agenda 63, 2063 of the African Union and so on, and embracing regional integration and continental integration and the free movement of persons and what actually happens on the ground. And I think a lot of it is based on perhaps a misperception of the what is associated with freeing the movement of persons. There's often a fear, perhaps, that it would allow uncontrolled inward migration, or it might allow economic migration that possibly takes away, as the feeling might be, or the sense might be, jobs from nationals of the country or citizens of the country. There might be security-related worries and concerns.
I was wondering whether it has to do with revenue, because you charge people for a visa, you make money out of that.
I think the reality on the ground is it is a very important issue for many countries. Cameroon charges, and this is public information on their website, charges very high visa-free fees for a casual traveler, 150 or 160 euros, I think it is. So these are clearly revenue streams that countries still see as a revenue stream and something that they might be loath to forego if they offer visa-free movement. So it is certainly still seen as something that is providing national income. And when it is reflected in the national accounts, then that is, in a way, proof in the pudding that this is still an important consideration around visa-free access or easing the movement of persons or even dropping visa fees altogether.
But what effect would visa-free travel have on countries and their revenue? Wouldn't it increase the number of people who come, especially if the fees are prohibitive?
I think most economists would argue that is exactly what would happen, that if you ease the movement of persons, the small cost foregone, the opportunity cost of waiving visa fees will be far outdone by the economic benefits of having inward travelers that spend their tourist money here or that are here for business purposes or that are here to provide or consume a service in another country, that these things, these economic impacts far outweigh any visa revenue benefits that a country might have. But that is often a disconnect in the thinking of African countries where that is maybe not seen. The revenue that is directly obtained from visa fees is an easy win, so to speak, or seems to be an easy win. Yet the broad economic benefits of easing the movement of persons and removing visas or visa restrictions in this regard for the casual traveler are often more secondary impacts and maybe not as easily measured and seen.
So Benin, Rwanda, Seychelles and the Gambia have no visa restrictions for Africans. What have they gained from this?
There are several benefits that easing the movement of persons provides countries, and they will be motivated by different things. I mean, I think Kigali in Rwanda has become a bit of a conference capital in the African context because it has just become very simple to travel to Rwanda. So I think there are many layers of benefits. But I think one thing that is also quite pertinent is that often countries that are lower on the income scale are often more open to easing the movement of persons. In fact, in the latest index, 18 of the top 20 countries are all either lower income countries or lower middle income countries. So they certainly see a benefit or a potential in easing the movement of persons in terms of attracting certain benefits to them, be it tourism, be it economic benefits, just simply easing the movement of persons. They see the bigger picture, one could say.
And would you say that countries that are more protectionist, besides for ideological reasons or for reasons of war, conflict and so on, are being protectionist because they want to preserve their resources?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to understand all the reasons, but certainly, you know, there's often anecdotal evidence for exactly as you say, there are security concerns, although many studies have debunked security as being a major true concern. There might be also concern that local jobs might be taken away, so to speak, by inward travelers, even though generally visa-free travel doesn't mean the right of residence. And I think it often becomes a political issue. So a country that has fairly high unemployment rates, yet has open borders or has a very liberal visa policy, will be perceived to be more open to non-nationals or just inward travelers. And it can become a bit of a political hot potato. Whether it's justified or not is a different story.
Thank you so much. This has been really interesting.
Thank you too. Thank you for the opportunity.
And enjoy Cape Town.
Thank you very much.
Eckhart Naumann, an independent economist and associate of the Trade Law Center in Cape Town. Focus on Africa was produced by Bella Hassan and Amy Leibovitz here in London. Charles Kitonga was in Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer. Francesca Dunn, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. And in the next edition of our sister podcast, Africa Daily, they take a closer look into US President Joe Biden's trip to Angola. Don't forget to find us on air, in a podcast, or on YouTube. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.